Yeah, thank you. Thanks very much, Karimabathi, and thanks. Thanks everyone for people who invited me here, and then just to be here. It's very, very nice. And yes, as Karimabathi said, I was here. The last time I was in Bristol was 10 years ago, not far from here, when we lived in that community doing that Karuna appeal. And at that time, it's so busy doing one of those appeals, I just had time to pop briefly into the centre. So it's nice to come here more substantially. So I'm going to be talking to you tonight within the theme that you've been exploring, within this theme of integration. So yes, I'll give some thoughts about that theme. I know it sounds like you've been exploring it quite thoroughly already. So, I thought I'd start with the Buddha, which is, always a good place to start. So we've got, two images of the Buddha on the shrine. We've got this meditating Buddha, and then we've got the archetypal blue Buddha, Akshobhya, on the shrine. And, who is the Buddha? Maybe it's a good question, right? Who is the Buddha? So the Buddha, as you know, was born a human being just like us, and then realised this state. If you can't really call it a state, realise this way of being that we call enlightenment. So what the Buddha realised in becoming enlightened is, a whole new consciousness dawned. Something happened in a human being that had never ever happened before in a human being. Not just that it never ever happened before, but that nobody could have even imagined happening. It was a state of being that nobody had yet even imagined. And then that manifested in the Buddha. So a completely new way of being human. So the Buddha was a human being and then discovered this completely new way of being that went completely beyond the physical senses, completely beyond the rational mind. A way of being that didn't have any self-reference in it at all. So for a Buddha, for an enlightened being, maybe start the other way. For unenlightened beings, for us, if we're unenlightened, everything, every state of mind, no matter how lofty we experience, while we're unenlightened, sooner or later comes back to what's in it for me. That's the sort of sad but true fact. It always comes back to what's in it for me, in some form or another. It might be the sort of other version of this might be like, why is this happening to me? If it's something unpleasant, we might think, why is this happening to me? What's in it for me? Why is this happening to me? What do people think about me? I don't know, do people recognise those states of mind? Yeah. So sooner or later, sometimes sooner it comes back to that, sometimes all too soon. Sometimes that can be attenuated for a while. Say we're on retreat or we've been meditating a bit or we're just in contact with beauty or in contact with generosity. It might be attenuated for a bit, but then sooner or later it comes back to, like on a bit of elastic, what's in it for me? For a Buddha, for an enlightened being, that doesn't happen anymore. It's like the elastic's broken. There's no self-reference at all. And it's not relevant anymore. It's not even that the Buddha's thinking the opposite of what's in it for me. That's completely irrelevant. And something completely new has come into me. That doesn't mean it's a full stop. Sometimes it can be hard to imagine life without craving or ill will. But when one is free from that, there's just this flow of energy. So it's not nothing. And that's why the figures of the Buddha are depicted as very beautiful, very luminous, very bright. And that's why we have the word enlightenment, actually, this light source, this source of light. Yeah. So That's what the Buddhist life is lived for. That's what the Buddhist life is lived for, is to be completely free of that self-reference, what's in it for me. And then when one is free of that, you can be a force for good in the world. Until you're free of that, you can't completely be a force for good in the world. You can try your best, but to the extent that you're not free of self-clinging, to that extent, you can't completely be a force for good in the world. Don't wait till then, though, to try, and just, keep trying to be a force for good in the world. But you need to both those things. You need to be trying to be a force for good in the world and to be freeing. We all need to be freeing ourselves of that self-clinging. But how we're going to do that is the difficulty, because that self-clinging is just part and parcel of being human. This isn't a moral issue, really. It's an existential issue. That comes with the territory of being a human being, that what's in it for me. We're not sort of judged for that. Buddhism or the Buddha would never judge us for that. That's just what it's like to be alive, unenlightened. But what the Buddha showed us is there's a different way of being alive, a much more free way. The thing is, we can't think ourselves to that. So when we're thinking of, how can I do that? We can't think our way to it. And also, even perhaps deeper, more mysterious, is it's not something added on to us. Enlightenment isn't something that we add on to us. Bhante Sangharaja, my own teacher, he says, our practice is not to fill ourselves with profound and precious teachings, but to make ourselves fit to receive them. So enlightenment isn't something we add on to ourselves. What we can do, though, with our Buddhist practice, with Dharma practice, is try to create a fit mind, a fit mind for wisdom, even enlightenment. Yeah, we try and work on creating a fit mind. That's the first thing to do. And when I say fit mind, it's kind of fit in all senses of the word. It's quite multifaceted, the word fit, that little word, because it means a suitable mind. So fit mind means a suitable mind. So we use the word fit in that way, don't we? I don't know, this water's fit for drinking or unfit for drinking, as the case may be. So a fit mind is a suitable mind. It's a mind that's prepared and ready, like we have sort of fit for action, don't we? So it's a mind that's prepared and ready, and it's a mind that's healthy. It's a mind that's healthy. So we need a fit mind. If we want to embark on this Dharma life proper, and with this vision of enlightenment, we need to create a fit mind, in order to embark on that. So we need a fit mind for enlightenment. We kind of need enlightenment for a fit mind, I think. I was just thinking about this more recently, that if we don't have that vision of enlightenment, well, I don't know, I hope I'm allowed to say this. I was thinking of something like a topic like integration. If we don't have the vision of enlightenment, something like integration, it's a bit sort of worthy, isn't it? Or even a bit boring in a way, if I'm allowed to say that. If we're not doing it for something, enlightenment gives us a reason to start off and to start this first great stage of the path, integration. I've been like slightly provocative saying it's boring. Maybe it's really interesting, but I just thought, I was going as far to think this morning, I thought, no person really should be interested in integration for its own sake, not really. Not if you're really a sort of, I don't know, if you're a sort of alive kind of vigorous person, don't be interested in integration for its own sake, Otherwise, you'll just end up a kind of neat, tidy person. We don't really want that, Only be interested in integration I think if you're interested in enlightenment, that gives it a reason. Yeah. Otherwise, I don't know, just go wild or something, you know. But if you're interested in enlightenment, then be interested in integration. Yeah. As, yeah, so there's my, you can always argue with me later when there's questions. But so we need a fit mind for enlightenment, but we need this vision of enlightenment, I think, to make the practices that we do, all the meditations we do, the mindfulness of breathing, the metta bhavana, the practice of ethics, we need the vision of enlightenment to make them make sense. Otherwise, well, you know, if we practice ethics, we'll end up as nice, good people. That's possibly preferable to being bad on nice people. Only possibly preferable. You know, and meditation will make us kind of calm, kind of mindful people, you know. But that's, I think that's not a very good vision of a human life, to be nice and calm, you know. We want to actually be enlightened, and that's... we want this new kind of mind that's, yeah, this completely new, free mind. So that's why we're practicing integration. Okay, so that's my starter. So that's by way of introduction to the talk and the theme. I wanted to move on, though, and I wanted to talk, I wanted to use an image. We've just celebrated Parinirvana Day. I think last week at your Sangha night you had an enactment even of some of the Parinirvana Sutta. Parinirvana, of course, is the passing away of the Buddha. And the Parinirvana Sutta is a long sutta. It's a long story about the last days of the Buddha. And I think you had an enactment of the first part of that. So in this talk, because we're in the proximity of Parinirvana Day, it was just last week, I thought I'd use a few images from that time because I've been dwelling with them. So the Buddha is, by the time of his Parinirvana, his final passing away, he's an old, old man. He's in his 80s. His body is all broken. He says it's like an old cart held together by pieces of rope. And he's doing a final tour. And he comes to his final resting place, and it's in the sal tree wood. So I'm not quite sure what sal trees are, but I think they're very tall and willowy and have beautiful leaves and blossoms. He comes to a sal tree forest, and there's a stone couch, and he lies down. And you'll have seen probably images of the Buddha lying down in that lion's position, where he's just lying on his side. So that's him about to pass away, about to go into Parinirvana. Parinirvana, by the way, means nirvana without remainder. So it's actually a celebration, the Buddha's passing away, because it's the final supreme nirvana. Anyway, he's between these two sal trees, and as soon as he lies down, unseasonably they come into blossom, and the blossoms rain down on the Buddha, so that the blossoms rain down on him in homage to him in worship. The blossoms themselves are paying homage to the Buddha lying there. So there's an echo in that image with another image of flowers raining down on the Buddha, which some of you will know very well. The Buddha, on the night of his enlightenment, just sat down to meditate, and we're told that he was attacked by Mara. Mara is a personification of, well, sometimes he's called the Lord of Death, but it's a personification of all the forces that hold us back. Mara's the, you know, it's like Mara's the voice that when you've, you know, you've decided you're going to get up early every single morning and meditate, and Mara's the voice that's just like, oh, you know, bed's so nice, you know. So Mara's the voice that holds you back whenever you're trying to make progress. So Mara comes to visit the Buddha on the brink of his enlightenment, and one of the things Mara does, he does all sorts of things, but he attacks the Buddha with weapons. So he throws like arrows and boulders and all sorts. And it's really, really beautiful, actually, because we're told that as all those weapons touch the aura of the Buddha, they're transformed into flowers, and those flowers Just rain down on the Buddha. Yeah, so all the arrows are turned into flowers and they rain down on the Buddha. Now, I think this is a symbol of integration at the highest level, because you could see those arrows are all the forces of anger and ill will that are still still to be integrated in the Buddha's psyche, that are still, they're left over, they're not yet converted to the Dharma, yeah? That's what they represent. But as they come in contact with the Buddha's order, they are converted, they're transformed, they become flowers and they rain down on the Buddha. So all the forces are unified, yeah? That's what integration means. It means all that, all, everything in our being is unified. So as the flowers rain down, you know, they just fall on the Buddha, and quite soon after that, that same night, he becomes enlightened. So I thought there's an echo in those two images of the flowers raining down, and I'll come back to the first image later. The first image I said, which is the second thing that happened, sorry, that's a bit confusing. So yeah, so there's the arrows at the Parinirvana, and then there's the flowers at the Parinirvana, and the arrows turning to flowers at the actual enlightenment, which is a symbol of integration, and the transformation shows that all these forces are now unified. When the arrows are turned into flowers, everything now is going towards enlightenment. There's nothing left over. There's no forces that are doing something else, yeah? Usually in our lives, if you're anything like me, there are many competing forces going on. You know, we want to get up and meditate, but then we stay in bed. All sorts of different things. We want to be skillful, but then other things kind of tempt us away from that. And I've got a very strong image of that that stays in my mind from something that happened a long time ago when I was looking after my little nephew for a while. He was about three. His mum was really sick at the time and I was looking after him. I'm not very used to children, or I wasn't at the time, so I was trying my best, but I didn't really quite know how to look after him, and he was really traumatised because his mum was seriously ill. Anyway, I took him swimming one day, which was probably a major mistake, really. So I took him swimming to the swimming pool. And we were both in the water, just in the shallow end, obviously. We were both in the water. We're probably quite deep for him because he was only three. And I must have done something. I don't know what I did. I must have upset him in some way. And what I remember is this tragic little incident is he was, because I'd upset him, he was trying to fight me. So he was trying to kick me and push me away. But of course, he couldn't swim, so he also was trying to grab onto me at the same time. So it was such a sort of tragic thing. So you had this simultaneous him, sort of hating me, but needing me at the same time. So he was both pushing me and pulling me. Like, he didn't know what to do at first, you know, he would push it and then he would grab me. And I thought, I did reflect on that, because I thought, oh, that's what we're all like all the time, really. We're just pushing and pulling, you know. We both want things and we don't want them at the same time. You know, we want to meditate and go deeper, but we're sort of addicted to the surface of our minds, you know. So we're constantly ricocheting, just like he was. So mostly we're not integrated. So yes, just keeping with this image of the Buddha on the brink of enlightenment and the arrows turning into flowers. Well, where did those arrows come from? So what we say is they came from Mara, as I've explained. They came from Mara, this personification of these holding back forces. Why did Mara get interested, though? Why did Mara get interested? So Mara got interested, I think, because just before that, the Buddha had made his great vow. So when the Buddha had this whole epic journey towards getting to this point, which there isn't time to tell that whole story now, but he tried all different things, and then finally he just sat beneath this tree, which became the Bodhi tree, and he made his great vow, and he said something like, Flesh may wither away, blood may dry up, but I'm not going to move from this spot until I've realised enlightenment. He didn't even know what enlightenment was, but that was what he did. So that was like a sort of lion's roar of a vow. You know, he made this great vow. A vow, very, very serious thing to make. In our own tradition, we only really make vows. Well, we can make some smaller vows, but the real main vow we make in our tradition is at ordination. At ordination, we take a vow, we make a vow, and that vow is witnessed by others. And we make a vow, and that vow is that we're going to centre our lives around the three jewels, that they are going to be the integrating factor for us, the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma and Sangha. And you could say the ordination training, it takes a long time to be ready for ordination. There's a lot of training involved. And that training, if you to sum it up, you could say that training is to ready oneself to be able to take a vow, to take a solemn lifelong vow. That's what we're doing when we get ordained. So it's a very, very serious thing to make a vow. So the Buddha made this vow, this absolutely blood-curdling almost vow, that he was going to get enlightenment or die trying. That's really what it is. So very, very serious vow. And that on making that vow, the forces of Mara were called up, yeah? And on making that vow, it was like, you could say Mara, even to say got interested is a bit too weak. It's like Mara heard that vow and was like, oh, we'll see about that. You know, Mara was called into being. If the Buddha had just said, oh, you know, there's a nice looking tree, I'll just sit down there and see what happens, sort of thing. I don't think Mara would have got very interested, yeah? And I don't think the Buddha would have got enlightened, yeah? If the Buddha just said, okay, I'll just sit down here and watch my mind for a bit and kind of go with the flow and see what happens, Mara wouldn't have got interested. Mara got interested because of the vow, yeah? Well, that's what I think, anyway. Again, you can argue with me if I leave enough time for argument. But Mara got interested because of the vow. And I think for us, how this is relevant to us is that to be... Well, this is certainly what I found. To try and be a whole person rather than a fragmented person, rather than being like little Jack in the swimming pool, pushing and pulling and having all these conflicting forces. To be a whole person in all one's heights and depths as well as breadth, then I think, or certainly what I've had to do, is I've had to make commitments and take responsibility. That's what I've had to do to become a more whole person. I'm far from whole. So that's what I think, certainly I've had to do. And I think this may hold true for all of us. But then that immediately raises a question. If we're saying we have to make commitments, or if I'm saying I have to make a commitment, I have to make commitments and take responsibility, what am I committing to? And what am I taking responsibility for? Is the next question. So I think that when we commit to something, we have to commit to something that can bear the weight of our commitment, yeah? We have to commit to something. In other words, we have to commit to something that's much bigger than us, yeah? We have to commit to something that's much bigger than us. And actually much bigger than anything. I've written down here that we have to commit ourselves to a transcendental ideal. That sounds very grandiose, but I think I'll stick with it, because I think we have to, if we're going to commit ourselves to something, fully commit, it has to be something that goes beyond this mundane world. Because if we commit ourselves to anything in samsara, in the mundane world, in this world of appearances, sooner or later, our commitment will bump against it. There'll be a ceiling to it. If it's in the mundane world, it will be subject to impermanence, it'll be subject to impermanence, so it won't hold our commitment. We'll bump up against it. Yeah? We have to commit to something, to a value that's beyond the mundane. So it has to be transcendental in that sense. It has to transcend mundane values for us really to commit. And I think it has to be transcendental in the sense that it kind of has to transcend itself as well. It has to be limitless. Well, I think that's certainly what I found in my own experience. It only works to commit myself to something that hasn't, in a way that's receding away from me, but in a positive way, that there's always further to go, where there's always more to commit. I get, otherwise, you know, one will bump up against it. Your commitment won't be able to keep going. You know, there'll be just this ceiling to it. So I think, you know, in any human life, whether it's a Buddhist life or not, I think the art is to look for something to commit to that is a value that's certainly beyond ourselves, but also that's limitless. You know, so, you know, we might, look for a value like truth or beauty or love, something that there's always more. You know, there's always more. That's what I mean by a transcendental ideal. Of course, for Buddhists, we commit ourselves to the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and Sangha, but we commit ourselves to them as these transcendental ideals. So that's what we commit to. And then what do we take responsibility for? Or what do I take responsibility for? So I think responsibility is always in relation to other people. But what I want to quickly say is we're not taking responsibility for other people. You can't take responsibility for other people, just as no one can take responsibility for you. But we take responsibility in relation to other people. And again, certainly, maybe it's, you know, I was going to say maybe it's just me. I don't think it can just be me, but certainly the path of responsibility, the path of trying to take a bit more responsibility has been something that I found I can integrate around. Integration doesn't just happen sort of in the abstract, as it were. We integrate around something. So I just thought I'd share a personal example of this with you. Where I've tried to take responsibility and where that's been an integrating factor. So my strongest example of this in my life so far has been when I became a private preceptor for the first time. So I'll explain what that term means. So as you know, in our Tri Ratna movement, we have ordinations of people, and we have examples of that here, where we have order members and people going off to become ordained. And then you're ordained in relation to spiritual friends in general, and also in particular to people who are your preceptors, to people who give you the precepts, give you the refuges and precepts that, as we chanted earlier, but they're given ritually and they're given as vows, as I was saying earlier. So in our order, the way it works is after you've been ordained for a while, 10 years or so, if someone asks you to be that witness, to be their private preceptor, you can say yes, yeah, and you can respond to that. So a number of years ago, I was asked for the first time, would I be someone's private preceptor? And I experienced such a sort of mixture. It's a very, very joyful, lovely thing to be asked. Usually someone you have a connection with, a dharmic connection with. You're very pleased for them that they're taking this step of moving towards ordination. So it's a joyful thing. It's a sort of rejoicing in the connection you have. But also, Goodness me, it's a challenging thing. It's a very, very challenging thing. Because if you're going to witness someone else's ordination, someone else's commitment, someone else's making these vows, then you're immediately thrown back on yourself and your own practice. So as soon as I was asked, my life was suddenly in sort of sharp relief. And what I saw immediately was the parts of my life where I wasn't living up to my Buddhist ideals. They were thrown into focus very, very strongly. And they were thrown into focus, I think, because I was now in relation to someone else. It wasn't just about me anymore. It was directly in relation to someone else. Now, of course, it's never all about me. It's an illusion to think anything is ever all about me, because we're interconnected with everyone. But the illusion that it was all about me, suddenly I couldn't hold anymore. I completely saw that there were things I was going to have to get sorted out, because that was going to really matter, not just for me, but for this person who'd asked me to be their preceptor. Oh yes, because the bit I've missed out, it isn't just an internal feeling of, am I good enough to be this person's preceptor? The whole order gets to comment. Every single order member gets invited to, if they want to see whether you're a suitable person or not. Yeah, whole order, 2,000 people, if they want to get to say that. Luckily, they don't all have an opinion, but quite a lot of them do, actually. So yeah, so it's not just an internal thing, the whole order. But even as an internal thing, in particular, there was one relationship of mine, one friendship, which wasn't really up to scratch. We'd had a big falling out. You might know this kind of thing, or maybe you don't fall out with people, but I do from time to time. We'd had a big falling out. We'd made it up, kind of. You know, we'd made it up, kind of. It was all right. You know, it was all right. No, we weren't kind of, you know, hostile to each other. We were getting on all right. So in a way, that's always a bit dangerous, isn't it? Because you can then settle, you know, it's that the good is the enemy of the best sort of territory. It was all right. It was good enough, I thought. But as soon as I was asked to be someone's private precept, I immediately thought, Subhadramati, this isn't good enough. This isn't good enough, you know. And I sorted that friendship, that relationship. And of course, was really glad I did, because then that becomes its own reward. So they had immediate sort of, I'm calling it sort of horizontal integrating effect, that this conflict, anytime one's in conflict, that's disintegrating. You can't be in, you're not integrated to the extent you're in conflict, because that by its nature is disintegrating. All unskillful and mental states are forces of disintegration. So that disintegrating factor in my life was resolved, and that's what I mean by this horizontal integration that happened. Yeah. Then, so okay, so that was sorted. So that was all good. And then, of course, they came to the ordination ceremony, which most of our ordinations happen on long ordination retreats in Spain. And I've been lucky enough to be on a few of these long ordination retreats. I had already been on one, the helping, doing the cooking and so on. Satyalila was there as well. And I remember watching the ordination ceremonies which took place on that long retreat and being absolutely the most inspired I'd ever been. I mean, I just remember like tears of inspiration pouring down my face. And I wasn't a preceptor at that time, so I was watching the women conducting the ordinations, just full of heartfelt admiration for them. I remember looking at them and thinking they're all so different. And each of these different women believes this is the best thing to do with their lives, so it must be true. Yeah, it must be true. Because these women, all of whom I looked up to, all of whom were very different, were, I could see, were totally committed to ordaining other women. So I took great inspiration from that. So I was really, I was very, very, very inspired. So that had been the previous year. So then the next year, I wasn't just going to be an observer, as it were. I was going to be taking part in this ritual directly because I was going to be one of these preceptors. So, of course, I thought, oh, well, this is going to be like double the inspiration now because I'm actually in it. What happened was very different, because what happened was this immense doubt arose in me, this most immense doubt. We were on the Spanish mountain. On the ordination retreats, we either wear robes or dress in blue clothes. And there we were, and I was just thinking, what are we doing? You know, what are we doing? We're on this Spanish mountain, all dressed in blue. You know, we've been up here for 3 months. We're remote from anyone. What good is this going to do anyone in the world? You know, so it was very, very, very strong doubt. Now, if you had asked me 5 minutes before, have you got any doubt in what you're doing, I would have said, definitely not. I would literally would have sworn on my life that I did not have any doubt. So I was aware enough to see, even within the doubt, I thought, oh, I know why this is. It's because I'm not just observing this ceremony. I'm not just a kind of inspired onlooker. I'm in it, you know. And that... So that's like that called up Mara, if you like, that called up Mara in the form of doubt. It took me some time to resolve that doubt, but I did resolve it. It took me till I came back to London, and then I actually just spontaneously resolved in the middle of a puja one day. But although it was very, very... it was quite a difficult sort of thing. There I am, supposed to be like doing this whole big ceremony, and I'm the preceptor and everything. There I am, secretly having all this doubt, you know. So it was uncomfortable, even painful at the time. But you see how it was integrating, because then something I didn't even know was there got called up. I feel that was a more vertical integration, because something got called up from my depths. I had to look higher. I had to really look to the Buddha for how am I going to resolve this. I knew I had to resolve it. I had the incentive to resolve it. And that's the other thing, because when you are someone's preceptor, there's, you know, you're doubly tenfoldly committed to, you know, to the whole thing. So I was able to resolve it, but what I saw was it was only by taking the step of taking some more responsibility that called that up and then made it be able to be somehow integrated. So hopefully out of that, I think I must have become a slightly bigger person, slightly more whole person out of that experience. Without taking that responsibility, I don't believe that would have happened. So taking the responsibility in relation to another person brought in the sort of bits around the edges that weren't integrated on this horizontal level, and sort of drew up and drew down, as it were, on the vertical axis, drew up the work yet to be done in me, the unconscious, unintegrated parts. I had to look up, I had to look to something beyond me in order to resolve that. I had to look to the Buddha, as it were, to resolve that. That was quite a big example in my life. There's lots of smaller examples where, you know, just taking responsibility, I find, makes me a more whole person. Even little things like the London Buddha Centre where I come from, I teach a couple of the classes every single week. I mean, loads of times, I must confess, I hope this isn't a shocking bit of information, I don't feel like going. Before, I think, oh, it'd be so nice to have a night off. But, you know, you can't really have a night off if you're the teacher, you know, so you go. And then I'm always glad I went, you know, but if I hadn't made the commitment to go, maybe I'd have just gone down the least common denominator, not gone, and, you know, not learned and not become more integrated. So I think, for me, certainly, almost putting myself in situations that in a certain sense I can't get out of is good. Obviously, I'm doing that consciously. Obviously, I could get out of them if I really wanted to, but it sort of draws something up, and in that way, I think it's integrating. So that's the path of responsibility. So let's go back to that image again. So I started talking about this image of the Buddha on the brink of enlightenment and the arrows becoming flowers as a symbol of integration. And then you've got this other lovely image of this between the twin sal trees. There's only flowers, there's no arrows anymore. And I think that can only be because there's nothing left over. By the time of his parinirvana, there's nothing to be transformed anymore. There's only flowers, yeah? There's nothing that needs transforming. So the arrows to flowers is like integration in action. When there's only flowers at the end of the Buddha's life, it's like integration fulfilled, yeah? And there's only flowers, there's no arrows anymore. So I think what that shows is that, again, a bit more poetic way of saying what I was saying at the beginning of the talk, that integration is the start of the journey. Yeah, we need integration. We need to become more integrated to create this fit mind as the start of our Dharma journey. But also, with these just flowers raining down, you've got integration at the end of the journey, at the end of the journey. And what does it look like? I just thought, well, what does it look like? What does integration fulfilled look like? And I thought we could look to the example of the Buddha at the end of his life to see what integration fulfilled looks like. So we don't know what happens after the parinirvana. What happens to the Buddha after the Buddha dies is one of the unanswerable questions. And it's where the Buddha, it's like a deliberately unanswered question. It's not just, the Buddha was asked that before he died, what happens to the Buddha when he dies? And he didn't answer, not because he didn't know, but because it's the wrong question. Anyway, that's the subject of a whole other talk, what happens to the Buddha after he dies. We don't know, nobody knows what happens to the Buddha after the parinirvana, but we do know what happens just before, because we have in the Parinirvana Sutta the document of this final journey. So, in the Buddha's last tour, he has lots and lots of encounters with different people, and I'm just going to tell you about a few. So, already ill, already knowing that he's going to pass away, he's making his last journey. And on that last journey, he meets Kunda, the silversmith. And Kunda's a disciple, and Kunda wants to offer a meal to the whole assembly. That was very common. And the Buddha accepts the meal. But the Buddha knows that there's something in that meal that is indigestible. And so he says to Kunda, he says, Kunda, that one thing, don't give that to the other monks, just give that to me. And then when I've eaten some of it, just bury the rest of it. So he makes sure none of the other monks eat this indigestible part. And he, the Buddha, does eat it. He's the only one that eats it. And it does indeed make him very ill. In fact, it results in him having dysentery. And in fact, this meal is his last meal because it's this dysentery that finally results in his last illness and his passing away. And the Buddha does the most lovely thing here. He realizes that Kunda might feel bad, even guilty, for, well, giving the Buddha a meal, well, kind of poisoning the Buddha, basically. Things so Kunda will think he's poisoned the Buddha by giving him this meal. And I don't want him to think that. So he sends a monk to go and say to Kunda not to feel bad about giving the Buddha his last meal. In fact, that it's a great honor. And like it's got, you know, uncountable amounts of merit to give the Buddha his last meal. It's as got as much merit as giving the Buddha his last meal before his enlightenment, to give the Buddha his last meal before Parinirvana. So you get this lovely, lovely thoughtfulness, just imagining what it would be like to be Kunda, and then sending the monk to tell him. And then you see this thoughtfulness again a little bit later on. And the Buddha's attendant, cousin Ananda, who's been with him for many, many years, suddenly the Buddha realizes he's not there. Where is he? This is by this time the Buddha's lying down on this stone couch. And Ananda's brokenhearted, and he's gone off and he's weeping. And the Buddha calls Ananda to him, and he says, Ananda, don't weep. First he gives him a teaching. He said, I've told you, Ananda, all things are impermanent, and even the Buddha's body must pass away. And then he encourages Ananda, because Ananda's saying, oh, you know, I'm not even enlightened yet, and the master who's so kind is going to pass away. And the Buddha says, first of all, he says, don't weep. And then he says, Ananda, you've been practicing really well. You've been attending to me all these years. You can gain enlightenment. Just keep trying and you will gain enlightenment before too long. And Ananda does. And then finally, he doesn't leave it at that. Then he rejoices in Ananda in front of the whole assembly. He just says, Ananda brings joy to everyone. His appearance is a joy and his teachings are a joy. So he rejoices in front of the whole assembly. So again, you get the Buddha's care. You know, the Buddha's literally lying on his own deathbed, but just caring for Ananda. And then just after that, a wanderer who's not a disciple of the Buddha comes by but wants the Buddha to teach. And he comes to Ananda, the attendant. He said, can I have a teaching from the Buddha? And Ananda said, oh, look, you know, it's a bit late, you know, the Buddha's like about to pass away. You've just come too late, you know, you can't have a, you know, you have to go away. But the Buddha overhears and he says, no, send Subhadra to me. And Subhadra comes and, the Buddha says, send him to me. He says something like, he's not a time waster, you know, his questions are genuine. And Subhadra comes and the Buddha not only teaches him, but actually ordains him. So he's the last disciple of the Buddha. He sees his potential. He sees that he's ready to learn. And then there's one more thing before the Buddha passes away. He wants to make sure there's no doubt left in the assembly. So he calls all the disciples and he asks them, he says, I'm about to pass away. He says, don't be left with any regrets. I always feel like, for heaven's sake, ask me now. You know, don't wish you'd ask me after I passed away. But the assembly is completely silent. And then the Buddha says again, has anyone got any doubts? You know, ask me now. Don't be left by regrets. And the assembly is very silent. And then the Buddha does really the most lovely thing. He says something like, he says, oh, maybe you're too shy to ask any questions. Maybe, you know, I almost imagine him thinking, oh, maybe the disciples think they'll look foolish or they'll ask a question that'll seem a bit foolish. He says, if you're too shy to ask a question in front of everyone, just whisper it to your friend and they'll ask for you. So lovely thing, isn't it? Lovely sort of thoughtfulness. But again, the assembly is completely silent. And so that means there's no doubt at all in the assembly of ordained people. And then the Buddha utters his final words, with mindfulness strive on, and passes into Parinirvana. So I think if we want to look at what integration looks like in fulfillment, and if we look to these last hours, these last days of the Buddha, what we see is love. We just see love in its fullness, just that exquisite love that's got imagination. You know, he imagines himself into the shoes of each of those people, of Kunda, the silversmith, of Ananda, of Subhadra, the last disciple, of the assembly, of monks. He imagines what it's like to be them. And that's what love is, really, I think, is when we can really imagine ourselves in someone else's shoes. So that's what, that's what a fully integrated mind is like. It's a mind of love. And I just want to finish. I've gone completely over time. There's no time for questions, I don't think, but sorry about that. But I just want to finish with the image again of the blossoms of the sao trees falling in adoration, falling in worship of the Buddha. Because what the Buddha said, he said, these petals are falling to worship the Buddha. He says, but the real way to worship the Buddha is to practice the Dharma. That's the real way to worship the Buddha, is to carry on practicing. So I think the real way for us to practice integration, to practice towards enlightenment, is to find a transcendental ideal and to live by it. So I'll leave you with that. So, thank you.